From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. There's a long section of scripture in the Bible. It's just five chapters into Genesis, in fact, that lists the generations from Adam to Noah. You might recognize this as the begats. Adam begat Seth, and Seth begat Enos, and Enos begat Canaan, and this goes on and on for a really long time, until we get to that guy who built a boat to survive a very big flood. And I was thinking about this as I was reading David Lipsky's latest book, which is A History of Climate Denial. Most people who've tried to tell this story go back a few decades, usually to the Reagan administration in the 1980s. But Lipsky wanted to know who begot Reagan's climate policies and what begot that and what begot that. And so this story starts a long ways back, not Adam and Seth, not that far, but if we want to understand how we got the hucksters and the zealots and the crackpots who have quite successfully managed to sow fear, uncertainty, and doubt about global warming, we have to start at least a couple hundred years in the past. And Lipsky does that in such an interesting way. More interesting, I assure you, than Genesis chapter 5. His book is like a time machine. It zips back and forth across the history of industrialization and electrification and scientific exploration and politics and crass capitalism. And like that chapter in Genesis, it doesn't arrive at the end of the story, but at a very conflicted period of time in history, a time, as it happens, that is marked by a climate upheaval unlike anything since Noah's flood. Lipsky teaches at New York University, and he's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. His fiction and nonfiction have appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, and The New York Times. If you've seen the film The End of the Tour, then you know David. He's played in that road trip movie by Jesse Eisenberg. And you might have heard his essays on NPR's All Things Considered. And he's had a number of best-selling books. His latest is The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial. David Lipsky, welcome.
Matthew, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
David, I think it's natural for people to think they are living through, you know, like the most dynamic time in human history. That's, you know, that's how I feel right now sometimes. And then, you know, I don't think we have anything on the people who lived through the years of Samuel Morse and Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla. Those were crazy times, and that's where you start this book.
That's right. It's I love that you were saying that. One of the things that was very fun for me in researching the book and getting to put these stories into this overall story is the uses that people would put this amazing new technology. So Samuel Morse has been working on the telegraph for years. He can't get anyone to back him on it. And then finally, in the 1840s, he is able to string a line from Baltimore to the Supreme Court, basically. And there are reports, first time it's used in news, everyone instantly sees what media can become. It's great for news. And he's reporting the Democratic Convention, which is in Baltimore, and they're reporting the data back to D.C. And in a pause, his coworker says, "Hey, what'd you eat today?" And he says, "Oh, I had a mutton chop and strawberries. What did you have?" And the guy says what he had. It's like just the kind of thing you're talking about. You know, you're talking about what you got from Seamless while you're checking what's on X. And that was within 4 or 5 days of the telegraph being in operation.
I guess I didn't really conceptualize like how quick just things started happening after that. So, you know, we're wired from Baltimore to Washington, D.C., and then within decades, you know, the country's increasingly wired. And then Edison comes along and he's like, "Hey, I got an idea."
Yeah. And the story is that Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla did this great thing, which is they found a use for electricity. So Steve Jobs, he knew that Apple's technology was great, but he didn't know how to sell it, which is just what it was like once we knew what electricity was, first half of the 18th century, later part of the first half of the 19th century, later part of the 18th century. Then we knew how to generate it. The question was, how do we sell it? And so Steve Jobs had this great phrase. He thought that first laser printing, people could put italics and bold on their own writing for the first time in history. And then the iPod were the killer apps that would finally sell Apple. And the killer app for electricity Edison realized was the light bulb. But what he really wanted to sell was the idea of a wire connecting every house because, hey, he was a profit-oriented person and he wanted to sell them the current. As just a footnote on that, the place he got the idea was the same way people sometimes hate their Wi-Fi providers or their cell phone providers, or they used to hate their cable providers. People hated the people who sold them Gaslight. Maybe that's why that word has such a bad odor on it even today, because they couldn't understand the bills and they thought they were incredibly high. Edison himself hated the gas companies. And then he thought, you know what? I could be the gas companies. And so he and then Tesla found a way to both generate electricity near cities and then put it on a wire and put it in homes for everything, for lighting, for cooking, for ironing, for fans.
And you say this is a sales story because it's not just a story of invention. There's like this integral part here where this guy comes along, Bruce Barton, and he's like, let me help you with that.
Bruce Barton. So Bruce Barton was so effective at the odd things he did that they would sometimes mention him as a potential senatorial candidate. And Mad Men is set in the world of advertising. It's sort of patterned on advertising agencies that were like BBDO. It has one of those very 1960s Rock Hudson Doris Day names, Barton, Burton, DeStern, and Osborne. He is the Barton. He's the second B in BBDO. And he got really famous for two things. Barton got famous, A, for one of the biggest, maybe the biggest bestseller of the 1920s. It's not The Great Gatsby. It's not A Farewell to Arms. It's not Sun Also Rises. So it's not Hemingway or Fitzgerald. It's Bruce Barton's The Man Nobody Knows. And it was his attempt. He's an advertiser. It's his attempt to rebrand the Jesus story as a story about a businessman.
Yeah, Barton makes Jesus like really cool in the story.
Yeah, exactly. He said, we naturally reject the pale-faced man with flabby forearms, the Sunday school Jesus. The real Jesus was that he was the most popular dinner guest in Jerusalem. He took 12 men from the bottom ranks of society and forged them into the greatest sales staff the world has ever known. Not just that he wrote it, but he understood his market, and it was a giant success. And Barton...
The audacity, right? The audacity. Like, I'm going to rebrand Jesus.
Yeah. His dad had been sort of an itinerant minister. So I think it's the audacity you have from growing up backstage. He's a Nepo baby when it comes to religion. But he did two great things. I always think of Barton because he said something which you know in your bones is true when you're shopping for phone tech or computer tech or food tech. He said in the late 1920s, there are too many brands. It's gotten too large. And this is the 1920s. So you got to figure it's a factor of 16 between then and now. So what the public will do is they'll say, we're not going to reach every decision individually. We will pin our faith on a few brands we recognize and can trust. And so when he was hired by General Electric, he did something that we still feel today. He said, look, public does not trust corporations. They have a funny idea that you just want their money and don't really care about them personally. What's the opposite of a corporation? It's a friend. And what do you call a friend if their name is a little complicated, like General Electric? You just use their initials, GE. So the campaign became GE.
And GE becomes, you know, one of the, if not the most powerful corporations in the world. 50 years after the first bulb made by Edison, they host this huge celebration for Edison. This is like a crazy week. The Golden Jubilee of Electric Lighting. Yeah. They call it a jubilee for one thing, which is a word we should use more now, I think, not just in reference to the royal family. This is a party. They throw a party that would put Jay Gatsby to shame.
The party is so wild. So the way Edison became Edison, he left home. His family had it's a story that everybody knows and tries to live and is always slightly afraid of living. His family had money, then they didn't have money. So everybody, all hands on deck. And so Edison got a job. He would wake up 6 or 7 in the morning and he'd go on the trains and he would sell candy and newspapers on the trains, make about $1 a day, come home 9 or 10 at night, leave it on the kitchen table, go to sleep, get out and do it again. He's like 14 or 15. He is so powerful by 1929 that during this Golden Jubilee week, President Hoover rides a train that Henry Ford has built, or has tricked out to exactly resemble the trains that Edison grew up working on. And Edison picks up the little tray that he used to use, and he walks up the aisle saying, you know, candy and newspapers for sale. And the president, President Hoover, then raises his hand and says, I'll take a peach.
You get the president of the United States is playing into your boyhood fantasies.
It's so wild. The president of the U.S. is in your live improv home movie.
And then they get to this celebration. There's all of these dignitaries there. Among them is Albert Einstein. Einstein says something here that is so prescient, not shockingly. He says, the great creators of technics, among whom you are one of the most successful, have put mankind into a perfectly new situation to which it has yet not at all adapted itself. And Einstein's right, of course. This all comes at a cost.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, though. I would love to talk about the cost because it plays into the idea that humans are attracted to, which is that we're living in the end times. But yeah, so at that celebration, and it was a wonderful scene to write and a wonderful scene to visualize. Edison was such a giant celebrity that by the time he was about 60, someone did this as an experiment. If you drew a picture of him on an envelope and dropped it in a post office box, the letter would be delivered to him. And then when his wife, because he's an older man, he's about 81 and his hearing is going. And so just to bring the telegraph back, I found this so touching. The way his wife communicates with him is by tapping her words to him on the back of his hand in Morse code. And when she tries to fix his clothes, he says, no, I'm just as young as I was 50 years ago when I worked in those buildings. And before the banquet, where the president is, the heads of all of America's major corporations, Madame Curie is there, he suddenly can't go in. It's one of those moments where someone is thinking about the whole sweep of their life. He says, I won't go in, and he burst into tears. And his wife, who knows him really well, says, get him a glass of more milk. And they give him the milk, and he goes in, and everybody is congratulating him. And Einstein, by radio, which is one of the things that he had made possible, Einstein says those beautiful words, which are, we're in a totally new situation to which we have as yet not at all adapted ourselves. And then a week later, the Great Depression.
And then we start learning the cost, right? Pollution from electrical plants. And then, you know, another part of the story is cars and Henry Ford. And part of it is that, the pollution we can see, but something else is going on here. This is the thing we can't see so easily, but which really isn't that complicated. Carbon emissions into our atmosphere.
We introduced a new factor to the place where we all live, which is, it was amazing. You and I are talking now on microphones. Edison also perfected how microphones work. So until the end of our last century, the microphone that he built for the phone was in every phone sold. He just was really great with machinery. One of his money guys said, should you tell me you could make a baby by machinery, I should not doubt it. But with the tremendous new introduction of this magical technology, there was a slight problem. The new factor was that we were putting more carbon dioxide into the air than had been done previously. And so if we can go back, so the story has to start there because that's where our story starts. But a weird thing is, at the same time, and the book is separated out into three different sections. It is separated into inventors, people who made the great world that we are all participating in right now, just by driving or, you know, walking for fitness or washing dishes. People who made that world, then the scientists who began like a team from CSI to think, wait, there's a might be a problem here. And that's the next section of the story. And then the third section, the last section, is the deniers, the people who said, no, there's no problem at all. So one of the weird things, Matthew, when did you first get aware of what was happening with climate or the anxieties about what was happening?
Oh, gosh. I mean, like, I'm thinking like the 1990s, right? Like the late 1990s, it feels like.
Yeah, that seems about right. The late 1990s were the first semi-binding. They were supposed to be binding international accords, the Kyoto Protocols, which are at 97 is when they're voted on. So yeah, that was when we really first started hearing it.
But this is all theoretical up until Edison and Tesla and Ford and industrialization, and we're actually now engaged in this experiment where we're putting CO2 into the atmosphere. And by the 1950s, scientists like Gilbert Plass and Roger Revels and Hans Suess and Charles Keeling are talking about this. And what's really remarkable to me is in the 1950s, they are telling the exact same story that scientists are telling today about why this is happening, why it's creating warming, which direction it's going. It's virtually identical to the story we're telling today.
Yeah, I was so thrilled to hear you say that. That's the reason that I wrote the book. I was stunned to learn that. And it made me, it's one of those things that makes you wonder. It's like discovering that your parents aren't your parents, or if you're in the attic and you realize that your family has royalty somewhere that they've turned their back on, some duchy that they, you know, that they could slip into and assume management of. We had this data in the 50s, and then it was really fun to go back. And this is the kind of thing that I love books for, and I love programs like Undisciplined for, which is just a way to remember things and to kind of express them. After, so Arrhenius thought that the reason why, it was just a super interesting thing that Arrhenius said, but he also thought it wouldn't come for two or three centuries. That's why we've got to light the coal mines on fire to warm Sweden now. The reason he thought it wouldn't happen is that the belief was that the oceans would take the excess carbon dioxide. They would essentially swallow it, and then they would slowly, over the course of decades, half centuries and centuries, burp it back up. And so we would have to wait for a more equable climate, is the phrase that Arrhenius used. We would have to wait until the 21 or 2200s. However, and people accepted his math, and they said, as Arrhenius has shown, the oceans are going to take up the excess carbon dioxide. At the same time, people were noticing that the world was getting warmer. And the one that stuck with me the most that I kept thinking about while I was working on the book was headline in the 1933 New York Times. And it's above the fold, which in the media business means this is the serious part. Even the front page is serious. And then above the fold, top half of the newspaper, that's the really serious part. So it's the part that Edison would have seen while he was selling newspapers up and down the aisles of those trains when he was 14 and 15. On one side of the newspaper, there's a story saying, we've got to stop Al Capone's speakeasies. Got to put those speakeasies out of business. And then on the far side of the above the fold head cover of the New York Times is Nazis promise to end attacks on Jews in the Reich. So there on the cover, left side is Al Capone, right side is Hitler, and in the middle, America in longest heat spell since 1776. Meteorologists record 25-year rise. Experts scratch their heads. No one can explain why. That's how far back in the last century, the noticing of something strange happening with our weather, that's how far back it goes. And in the 50s, one reason that Revel and Suess began doing the research is there were all these stories. Everyone was wondering, why is our climate so much different? It seems like older people will always say, when I was a kid, the snowbanks were over my head, and now, you know, they only come up to my knees. And they're like, yeah, genius, you're an adult now. And then even Life magazine was saying, no, the old timers are right. The weather really has changed. And in 1956, Roger Revel says, in 50 years or so, now this is the change, because it turns out the oceans aren't going to hold it. This could have a violent effect on Earth's climate. And he says that not in a scientific publication, not in some out-of-the-way place. He says it in Time magazine. And the headline on the story is not one that you wouldn't notice. The headline is One Big Greenhouse. We knew most of the stuff that we know and haven't done much about, we knew by the middle of the 1950s.
And this is really interesting because, you know, like at one point in the book, you compare the first parts of global warming to a detective novel. And I think there's a good analogy, but it's also a weird sort of mystery because we knew who the murderer was before the murder happened. We've known for 100 years, and we've been very certain for 70, 75 years.
That's right. And there was a lot of pomp and pageantry when the international scientific community finally weighed in with an absolute guilty verdict in February of 2007. It's one of the most moving parts of the book. But a scientist named Dr. Richard Alley, who has given his life to this and had lived through all the fights in February 2007, giant, huge amount of fanfare, giant press conference in Paris. And he says, we've done good science and we have confidence in this science. This is real. This is real. This is real. Now act. The ball's in your court.
But up until then, there's this sort of problem with scientists. Well, there's a couple of problems, actually. The first problem is that we're not going to go back to the dark, right? We're not going to stop driving cars and flying planes and living in electrified houses. We just weren't. But then this other thing is scientists, right? Like, people had started noticing strange weather changes. The effects were expected to come along in decades. And scientists are a little bit reticent to say anything with that sort of certainty. It takes them some time. And this is something that people who are disinterested in making any immediate changes because they are profiting off of the status quo can capitalize on.
So two ways to look at it. The passage says it's like a detective story. That's the first half. And the second half is like one of those city corruption stories where the DA on the take keeps finding a reason to keep the criminal at large. But the best, one of the great easy ways to think about this story is to think about the movie Jaws. Have you ever seen the movie Jaws, Matthew?
I have, yes. Okay. Everybody should watch Jaws. Yeah.
Jaws is great. Quentin Tarantino's favorite movie. Also Fidel Castro's. If you got that wide a spread, in the middle, you will find something to like in Jaws. Tarantino said a great thing about it. He said, it's the best movie ever made. It's not my favorite movie, but it's the best movie ever made. I love people who are that specific. But the plot of Jaws, we would recognize, which is Chief Brody, the chief is a sheriff. The cop in the movie, played by Roy Scheider. Think of him as one of the climate scientists. He goes out and he sees a body and he examines it, and it's clear to him it's been attacked by a shark. So he fills out the necessary forms and says cause of death is shark attack. And the mayor of Jaws takes him aside and says, you don't understand our particular problem. Amity Island is where the movie takes place. Amity is a summer town. We need summer dollars. And so they get him to agree to let them change the COD to a boating accident. The woman was not eaten by a shark. The first victim, she was hit by a propeller. Every time there's another death, they find a way to muddy it or to keep it quiet because it is not in the interest of anyone in the town. When it becomes public, there's a huge town meeting and no one in the town wants to acknowledge it because the town's basis is it's a summer resort. It's swimming. And our response to something that could risk our tremendous dependence on and wonderful dependence on electricity and what fossil fuels do for us, that is the exact same way we've responded to the scientists. Essentially, most of our leaders, and to some degree, even ourselves, we're kind of like the Jaws mayor saying, you know what, just see if we can keep this quiet. Maybe it'll go away.
That's David Lipsky. He's the author of The Parrot and the Igloo. David, thank you so much.
Matthew, it was a great conversation. Thank you.
Hey, Undisciplined listeners. I want to pull back the curtain a little bit on our program. We usually record our interview a few weeks ahead of time, and that allows our producer, Reagan Edelman, to edit the program down to 25 minutes and 55 seconds. Really, pretty much to the second every week. We want to make sure that time is really valuable to you. To do that, we usually interview our guests for about 35 to 40 minutes, and then Reagan cuts the show down from there. But something happened while we were recording this episode. Our guest was just sort of loving the conversation, and I was just sort of loving the conversation. And we went down all these historical and scientific rabbit holes. And we ended up with 1 hour, 47 minutes, and 6 seconds of interview tape about one of the most pressing subjects of our time, climate denial. So we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to cut this episode into two parts. And that still means there's going to be a lot of tape on the cutting room floor, but not an hour and 20 minutes of it. So please do join us next week when we get back to our interview with the journalist and author David Lipsky on how we arrived at a world in which even the simplest principles of climate science are so hotly debated. Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us, then you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.